This is Cliff Readers, and we're continuing on the Law Show WXPI, speaking with Dr. Jerome Kassir. Did I get that pronunciation correct, Doctor?
Yes, you did.
All right. I worked at that. And I know you from the book On the Take, which you authored, which I've read a number of years ago. And we're talking about the pharmaceutical industry in general, touching upon the medical marijuana issue, which has really kind of exploded politically of late. And, you know, I'd like you to tell me a little bit about yourself and what your life's work is.
Well, my life's work, I guess I would say I'm a fundamentally a doctor, a teacher, a writer, and for many years I was the editor of the New England Journal of Medicine. So at the moment, I guess I can be best described as a teacher and writer.
Mm-hmm. Well, the New England Journal of Medicine is really one of the great publications. In fact, I subscribe to it myself, and I probably understand about 20% of it, but it's really the way to stay in touch. And I think that's a great indication of the regard in which you're held by your own profession. Now, you have a particular interest in the pharmaceutical industry, and of course, you wrote this book, On the Take. And for those who have not read it, maybe you can tell us what your theme is.
Sure. So I was less interested in the industry itself than its relationship with physicians. I called attention, this is now in the early 2000s, around 2004, 2005. I called attention with my book called On the Take, How Medicine's Complicity with Big Business Can Endanger Your Health. I called attention to the relationship that physicians were having with industry. And those relationships varied enormously from their being on scientific advisory committees to being on speakers' bureaus for industry to receiving gifts and trips paid for by the industry. And my fundamental issue there was the question that the money that the pharmaceutical industry was giving physicians was having, what kind of effect that money was having on what the physicians themselves were doing in terms of their research, in terms of their recommendation of drugs, in terms of the issue of patient safety. So what I called for was a reduction in the amount of money that industry was giving to physicians. I also called for physicians to stop doing the kinds of things that would bias them. And fundamentally what I was talking about was the issue of conflict of interest. Conflict of interest exists when an individual has a dual loyalty. The dual loyalty in part is to the industry, which is giving them cash, or a trip, and to their patients. So fundamentally, the loyalty to of physicians should be always with their patients and not with their own pocketbooks. And so my focus was always on what the physicians were doing, which was not in the best interest of their patients.
Now, you wrote this book was copyrighted in 2005, 7 years ago. How have things changed? Has there been any change as a result of the Affordable Care Act or the rise of patient safety? I know I'm a member of the Patient Safety Authority here in Pennsylvania, and I helped put it together, and it's been a lot of interesting work there. And what I've seen there is, of course, the medical industry, pharmaceutical companies, or really in our case, associations of doctors and hospitals, they have a great interest in what we do, which is appropriate. So at the same time, they want to kind of control what we do. And there is that almost a symbiotic relationship. And I wonder, in terms of the pharmaceutical industry, how you see things having developed since 2005?
Well, I can tell you pretty much what's happened with respect to conflict of interest, and that is that at my urging, the Institute of Medicine conducted a study of conflict of interest, and also the Association of American Medical Colleges did the same thing and came up with pretty much the same conclusions that I had earlier about the relationship between physicians and industry. But still, nothing much happened until there was an activity at the level of the Senate in which two senators got together and decided to add something to the Affordable Care Act called the Sunshine Provision. And the Sunshine Provision basically said that starting this year, in 2014, that the pharmaceutical industry had to report all of the, basically all of the money it gave to physicians for any kind of engagement. Could be for speaking for them, for being on one of their boards, and so forth. Now, the idea there was to, what was the sunshine of the Sunshine Act? It was the idea to disclose all of the relationships that the physicians had with industry. The problem with that, of course, is that disclosing the conflict doesn't eliminate the conflict. It's still there. So even though the Sunshine Act was beneficial in terms of some disclosure of information, it doesn't solve the problem. And the problem is still that there's a too close relationship between the pharmaceutical industry and physicians. Now, I picked up on one word that you used, which was a symbiotic relationship. My view is that there should not be a symbiotic relationship, but a hands-away relationship, a relationship that is distant and sometimes even antagonistic, so that we shouldn't be collaborating with industry as much as we have in the past. Now, I will be the first to admit that that industry has been responsible for the development of many, many drugs, many of which I take myself. I wouldn't say I take many, but I do take some drugs that industry developed that otherwise would not make me function as well as I do. And so I'm very much glad that they have done that. What I'm concerned about is some of the things that they have done which is not in the best interest of patient safety and so forth. And that would include reporting information which was incomplete and involving physicians in ways that they shouldn't, including getting people to believe that there are new syndromes and new disorders that require drug therapy, promoting diseases that may not even exist so that they could sell drugs. Repeatedly, drug companies have been cited and sued by the federal government for all these misdemeanors, and they've paid substantial fines because of the things they've done. Now, what hasn't happened is that nobody's gone to jail because of it. And I believe that at some point along the way, someone should go to jail for doing things that are blatantly illegal.
Well, let me just reintroduce you to our audience. This is Cliff Readers on WXPI FM Radio, Public Access in Williamsport, Pennsylvania. We're talking with Jerome Kassir, doctor, professor, author, former editor of the New England Journal of Medicine. You have tremendous credentials to be talking about this, and we're really fortunate to have you and appreciate your time very much. But when you say people should go to jail because of the relationships between pharmaceutical companies and doctors.
I never said that.
Okay, maybe I misunderstood you.
What I said, you can go back and read the transcript, what I said was that to the extent that they violate the law and report information that is incomplete or erroneous, then the company should not just be fined, but somebody should be held accountable for it and, if necessary, go to jail.
I understand. All right, thank you for clarifying that. Let me get back a minute to the Sunshine Act, because I think a lot of people probably have never heard of that. Is that something that the pharmaceutical companies have to do on an individual basis? That is, say, you know, Dr. A, B, C, whatever, you know, how do they report that? Where do they report it? And does it include just financial payments or, you know, trips and dinners and samples? I mean, how does that, maybe you can give us some more detail about that.
Sure. The answer is that each company has to report individual payments to physicians. So if they give the physician a dinner worth $100, they have to report that. If they, if a physician gives a talk for them and they pay him $1,000, they have to report that. There's some minimal amounts that they don't have to report. But other than that, they have to report all that kind of money that physicians receive. And where do they report it? They report it on a website, which will be presumably activated sometime this year.
Okay, but it's not yet available.
Not that I know of, no.
Okay. All right, so that's something down the road. In terms of...
Actually, when I say down the road, it'll be available this year. I think my recollection is that it's supposed to be available in September.
Okay. Now, in terms of one of the things you mentioned that I think will, you know, pique a lot of attention is the concern that, and again, you know, correct me if I'm misstating this, I'm really not trying to put words in your mouth at all, is that, you know, there's a belief that people have that pharmaceutical companies, you know, they almost create the belief in a particular malady so that they can sell a drug for it. And you alluded to that as well. I wonder if you can explain that, maybe give some specific examples.
Well, sure. I think the one of the most recent ones is something called female. I wish I could think of the name of it. It's female sexual dysfunction or something.
Yeah, like a female impotency.
Whatever it's called.
Yeah. Okay.
The idea. Another example might be the notion that anxiety is a new disease, or that shyness is a new disease. And so the notion is when a company has a drug that seems to be useful, let's say, for severe anxiety, they will market that drug for not just severe anxiety, but for shyness. And they'll market it across the board, including ads on television and ads in magazines and that sort of thing. And the idea is that they're basically creating a market for their product. And sometimes what they do is they get a drug approved, and the drug then is given to hundreds of thousands or millions of people, even before we know about the side effect profile of the drug. And it turns out that sometimes those drugs are dangerous. And by the time it's recognized they're dangerous because it's been used in millions of people, then by that time they've already made $1 billion or more. And so if they're fined eventually because of holding back information or not appreciating the toxicity of the drug, then the fines are small potatoes compared to the amount of money they made.
Yeah, most people believe, I think, that, you know, the FDA, the government, is out there regulating all of this. And what's your opinion as to the effectiveness of the FDA to make sure that dangerous or useless drugs are not marketed?
Well, I think the FDA generally does a pretty good job, but sometimes they approve a drug based on only a couple of short controlled trials. And that doesn't give you necessarily a picture of what the drug would be like if it was given to people for a year or 2 years or 3 years. So the problem is that the amount of post-approval marketing studies that are done is very small. So that what they do is they get the drug approved and they stop studying it. And the fact is that sometimes side effects don't appear until much later. And so sometimes the FDA even requires them to do post-marketing studies, but they never get them done. So we never do know what the toxicity is.
The other, component that many people believe, well, there's a kind of regulation by virtue of lawsuits. And the U.S. Supreme Court and state courts have said that many of these lawsuits cannot go forward because of preemption. That is, the federal government has regulated the field, and therefore it does not appear that the threat of lawsuits really has much of an effect. What is your view about that? Is that an overstatement?
In fact, that's one of the problems, and that is that these companies are sued all the time, but the amount that they have to pay is kind of chump change, spare change, compared to the amount of profits they can make when marketing a drug. So, how much would it matter if a company like Merck or Pfizer paid a fine of $1 million? I mean, it's nothing compared to the amount of money they would make on a daily basis from the sale of a drug.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Again, let me identify you. This is Cliff Readers on WXPI, the FM, Williamsport Access FM radio. We're talking with Jerome Kassir, again, doctor, professor, noted author, wrote the book On the Take, How Medicine's Complicity with Big Business Can Endanger Your Health. Again, we really appreciate your time. What are two more points? And that is the concept of direct advertising. I think one of the things that I've seen a real change in what I've noted in my own life is the extent to which pharmaceuticals are directly advertised to people. Go ask your doctor for this and for that. What is that all about? Is that an attempt to get around the problem that that the pharmaceuticals have, where they go directly to the doctor? Does it raise another dimension of misrepresentation to the public? I mean, how do you feel about direct advertising, and is there any legitimate way that could or should be controlled?
Well, to some extent, there is a potential for direct advertising to patients to be a good. And that would be to alert people about the dangers of high blood pressure, or the dangers of diabetes, or the dangers of obesity. The problem is that the direct-to-consumer advertising is not often directed at those kinds of disorders. It's directed at male dysfunction, or a recent one was low androgen, that they want you to take some kind of drug and put it under your armpit to raise your androgen level, to give you more pep and more energy. So to the extent that they're doing that, they're doing what I described before, which is kind of inventing a disease, and because they have a treatment for it. There's an enormous risk of trying to get the a large number of elderly males who might feel a little tired to take a drug like an androgen, because there's risks of taking it, including increased blood pressure, risk of accelerating prostate cancer, and so forth. So, to the extent that that direct information to patients could be valuable. The fact is that most direct-to-consumer advertising is a process of trying to sell drugs to people who may or may not need them.
Doctor, let me ask you this last question, and that is, in terms of what the average consumer could do, people are listening to this program, how does a person get informed? What do they ask their doctor? What do they need to know when they read about a drug or arrive in their doctor's office and are told about a drug? What is the appropriate approach for the patient?
So I'm a big advocate of patients understanding their own illness. And understanding their own illness also means understanding what drugs are given for their illness and what their benefits are and what their risks are. And there are any number of sources of that kind of information that you can access on the web, especially some of the federal sources. The National Institutes of Health has a terrific website. The Public Health Service has a terrific website. And I urge patients to become informed about every drug that they take and to understand what the risks are. And the first approach, of course, is to talk to your doctor. And ask them very direct questions. Do I need this expensive drug? And why do I need it more than another kind of drug? And what are its side effects? And what do I need to watch for? And you need to have a dialogue with the doctor to have he or she explain as much as they possibly can about any new drug, especially.
Okay. Now, I did promise you, Dr. Cassera, that we would touch upon medical marijuana only because another guest said that it's become such a big political issue, a senator that we interviewed. So I'm wondering if you have any thoughts about that, if this is a safe alternative in terms of pain and other kinds of relief, if it's been studied enough, the potential side effects. Is it something that you've given any thought to in your role in your career?
I wrote an editorial back in the 90s about medical marijuana, and I would say that I would stick to what I wrote then, which was that if we're talking about desperately ill patients, people who are terminally sick, I have no problem with their receiving medical marijuana at all. It seems to me that material is relatively non-toxic, and if it produces any kind of relief, then I'm in favor of giving it to people who are desperately ill. Now, if you're talking about people who are not desperately ill, then that's another matter. The key there, it seems to me, is to try to find out whether the material smoked or given in another fashion is beneficial in a number of different conditions, such as migraines, such as chronic pain. And there, I think you need to do the proper studies. And as far as I'm concerned, I haven't seen the kind of studies that would be necessary to be sure about that. It's fair to say that marijuana is not a very toxic material. It's probably less dangerous than alcohol. So it is conceivable that it would be beneficial to give it to people with a variety of conditions. But I wouldn't be willing to promote that without the kind of proper studies that need to be done.
I see. Okay, well, I appreciate that very much. We've been talking with Jerome Cassera, who's a physician, professor, author, former editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, and author of the book On the Take, How Medicine's Complicity with Big Business Can Endanger Your Health. And we've been talking with Dr. Cassera on WXPI, FM radio, Williamsport, Pennsylvania. Doctor, thank you very, very much. It was really interesting talking to you, and hopefully we can have you back again soon.
Glad to talk to you, Clay.
All right, take care now.
Take care.
Bye.